The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Sometimes we talk about the spiritual journey, like I have today. Sometimes we say there's no journey, that there's nowhere to go. And in some ways they're both true. There's nowhere to go except to go fully here, to be really here in some new way. Not to go anywhere, not to have a particularly new experience, but to be present here in a new way. To wake up, to not be in conflict with ourselves and the world, to be compassionate to what is. In some ways to kind of, you know, we don't go anywhere, but we wake up to this here. And sometimes it's said that the way these two come together, a journey and there's no journey, is that the fastest way to go from A to B in the Buddhist practice, in this kind of practice, is to be fully at A. So to be fully here with yourself as you are, to be fully here with this experience. And so part of the study is to study how you're not fully here, how there's non-acceptance or resistance or judgments or pulling back or going forward. It's supposed to just really here with this experience, upright, still, here. And then if we learn to be here more and more fully, that puts us on a journey, you know, through our attachments, through our fears, through our holdings, through greater levels of maybe peace, love, variety of things that come along in that journey. But it's really the journey. So is there a journey? Is there no journey? You know, it depends on this metaphor. And but one of the ways of talking about this is that maybe it's a different metaphor, is that we're trying to shed our shell. There's a way kind of sometimes encased in a shell that limits us, that keeps us bound. And that what we're trying to do is somehow soften and break open the shell that we're kept in. You know, sometimes obviously a shell of fear, or a shell of conceit, or a shell of opinions and views and stories we tell ourselves, or a shell of our pain, our past pain, our historical pain we still have and still feel. It makes kind of a shell that limits us. The shell that's created when we have a very strong sense of me versus you, us versus them, creates a barrier, creates a, you know, barrier between people. And so to somehow break open that shell, or to change the metaphor slightly more, to break free from the cocoon that keeps our butterfly from flying. You know, we're all kind of bound in some ways. And one of the shells that limits us, shells that is often a source of a lot of suffering, is the shell the shell of self. And so ideas we have of who we are, the way we identify with things, the way we want to be represented by others, the way that we don't want people to see us, we try to, or we don't really care so much to build up a sense of self, but we don't want them to see us in a particular way. So we don't want to protect ourselves, so they don't see us in a negative way. Or we want people to see us a certain way, and so we try to create a persona that has a certain results. Or we're limited by past experience, or limited by what people have told us in the past about who we are. And especially when we're children, we're very, very, very susceptible to what other people tell us. And if people tell you you're this kind of way, or even if they don't tell you, if they act towards you as if you're a certain kind of person, a certain kind of way, sometimes it kind of becomes, you grow up and that's kind of like what you assume. This is true. Something relatively innocuous for me was in seventh grade. My art teacher looked over my shoulder at my drawing and said, "You have no artistic ability." And so that's kind of interesting, you know. And I had no identity around being an artist. I couldn't care less. It was like it did absolutely nothing to me in terms of my happiness, or, you know, I wasn't depressed or nothing. You know, just like, oh, it was just the truth. You know, it's just like, oh, you know, you learn that H2O is the you know, means water. You know, I never got depressed around that. You know, H2O, you know, means water. Oh no! And you have no artistic ability. It's like the same kind of valence for me, right? But it became an understanding. This is how it is. And I grew up with that idea. You know, as a matter of fact, didn't bother me, but just that's how reality was constructed. And then to find out in college that because I was tricked into it, that in fact I had a little artistic ability, enough that I really enjoyed drawing and painting and sculpture and things like that, enough so that I took art classes, and enough so that I actually became an art major for a short while. But it was really a ruse, because I didn't want to be an art major, but it was the only way to get some art classes. And I had been limited by this view that society had put on me. And there's much, you know, there's extremely painful views that society puts on people, and they internalize these views and who they are. Or we have experiences. And growing up, even our friends, I had friends, you know, in high school who treated me a certain way. And I assumed that I was that kind of person. Mostly I remember what they seemed to be never interested in what I had to say. So I would start saying something and they would interrupt me or stop. And I got this idea, I have nothing interesting to say, or I'm not worth saying anything. And so I had to become a Dharma teacher to make up for it. Captive audience. If I just had different friends in high school, I probably never would have chosen. I carried that with me for a good number of years, this kind of angst, or this kind of identity, and the sense of, oh, you know, that, you know, no one wants to hear what I have to say, was kind of a feeling I had for a number of years. And all kinds of experiences that we grew up, you know, oh, this is who I am. And it's hard to see in ourselves. Sometimes easier to see in other people. You see other people limiting themselves by some identity and say, oh, you know, you want to sometimes shake them. You know, no, you don't have to, you're more than that. Or that's an old view. Or someone treats you with an old view. You know, once upon a time you did something a little unusual. And now every time they see you, they think of you that way. Or maybe it wasn't once upon a time you did something unusual. For 10 years you did something unusual. 40 years you did something unusual. And sure enough, when they see you after 50 years or something, they like treat you as if you still did it. They haven't realized that in the last month you changed. And so they're holding you to, you know, you feel like, finally, I transformed, I'm changed, and they're still like going to do that. When I was a new practitioner of starting to meditate regularly, I was living with a couple of friends, and they weren't meditators, but I would get up every morning and meditate, and then for meditation I'd go to breakfast, and I kind of like my usual way of building up Gil or behaving as Gil wasn't really operating. I wasn't playing any social games or something. And so then, you know, I just come to breakfast and just be kind of, and in, for me, a nice way, kind of empty. I didn't have to do anything. I have to prove myself. I didn't have, I was just there. And I could feel over the days that tension started arising in my friends, because they expected the old guilt to be there. That's how they related to me. And there might have been, if I'd been wiser, there might have been some way to have found my way with it. But I wasn't so wise. I was 20 or 21. And so I thought, well, it's either I have to choose between my friends or meditation. And since I was living with them and working with them, I decided that I would give up meditation. So I gave it up for about 5-6 months while I was living with them. So this idea, you know, the identity, you know, I have to be someone for some other people, be someone for ourselves, prove ourselves. It's such a drag that one of my definitions of self, you know, someone asked me, what is the self? What's self? It's wind drag. It just slows us down, you know, just kind of like it, you know, it's, it interferes with life and things. And so, and it can be a shell. Some people get really boxed in, held tight. And the tighter that shell is, oddly enough, the more easily it is threatened, the more fragile it is, because it's kind of a constructed thing that has to be held in place. And then the weaker it is, the softer it is, the more fluid it is, and less it gets threatened by things. And then if there is no shell, then the shell is not threatenable. It can't break at all. An image that I kind of like about, you know, if things happen, so things go on in the world, and things happen, and the things that happen in the world, like if there's a ball, and you throw the ball through space, it just kind of goes until the momentum goes, and then it falls on the ground. But if you throw the ball against a wall, it gets stopped by the wall. Boom. And falls down. So if someone says to you that, people with glasses are odd, you know, so I could travel through space until the momentum fades away, and that's it. You don't hear about it again. Or it could hit the wall. And, you know, the wall is some identity, some idea of self that you have inside. So, you know, if one of you said, you know, people with glasses are odd, since I wear glasses, right? Now, you know, I'm so concerned about what people think of me. And now they'll think I'm a lousy person or whatever, and now I better make up for it. And maybe I'll explain to them why it's not the case. I'll prove to them that I'm not a lousy person or a grumpy person because even though I have glasses, or I'll go out and get contacts. You know, or all kinds of things, because it hits something inside of me, you know, in my mind, my identity, my fears, my concerns about needing to be someone for other people, and it hits something. But someone can say that people with glasses are crummy, and if it doesn't hit anything inside, it doesn't land anywhere. There's no idea that it encounters. It just goes right through. It doesn't have to go anywhere. And so part of the idea of conceit and self-identity in Buddhism is that we put up these walls for the balls of life. And we've erected the walls. And if we have a lot of walls, you know, then all kinds of things bounce off it and become a problem. But if there's no walls, all kinds of things can happen in life that just kind of goes right through space. It's like we're space. It's just kind of there. And I'm pretty confident if one of you said people with glasses are crummy, I probably there might be a teeny ripple in my mind, and the ripple would be, that's curious. how would anybody come up with that idea? Yeah, seems kind of, you know. So it would, you know, it wouldn't be like, it would do something, but it would just be a little ripple. It wouldn't be a wall. It wouldn't go boom. And so in Buddhism, often they have the idea that something goes up around the notion of self that doesn't have to be there. So a reference point that I like to use is I used to go backpacking in the Sierras, and all kinds of concerns that I have in the urban area fades away after a few days. And I could be eating my food in a campground and spill ketchup on my shirt, and I'm not concerned what people think about me. But if I was sitting here, you know, as a Dharma teacher, the founding teacher of IMC, And I had lunch with you here at the, you know, over there at the, you know, during lunch. Everybody's completely silent. And there's this, you know, squish goes the ketchup and what are people going to think of me? You know, now I'm, you know, I am not, you know, presentable as a Dharma teacher, you know. Oh, no. Then I have to do a lot of explaining and how this doesn't really, you know, this was an accident. It doesn't really reflect on who I am and what I'm capable of. And, you know, and if I had another shirt, I'd put it on. But, you know, it's not really, you know, I would give a whole Dharma talk to protect my identity and my view and what people think about me, right? So in the urban area, or social area, we can see, we put up these walls or put up these concerns that in other settings they disappear. And we start seeing that they're constructs. They come and go. They're a little bit arbitrary, as opposed to they're fixed. This is it. You know, so, you know, and that's what happens is many times we think our identity is it. It's like me and not being an artist. This is it. I mean, not even this. I mean, it's like just part of the fabric of the universe that, you know, you're this kind of person. You're this kind of identity. You're this whatever it means to be who you are. It's like this is it. And so then, because you have a wall, or you have this thing that's in there, things can hit that. Things can encounter that. Things can reflect on that. And one of the great things about meditation practice, you know, kind of like backpacking, if you go out backpacking long enough, is that the activity that constructs the walls can get relaxed. Because self-identity is something that we think about. Self-identity is something that we operate under. Self-identity is something that we believe. Self-identity is something that, you know, is a wall that a ball can hit. That kind of self-identity is a construct. It's something the mind has to create and make. It's not inherent. So you might say, Gil, you must be kidding, because there are some inherent identities. Like you, for example, you seem to be a man. And that's, you're stuck that way. You're a man, you know, and you're telling me that's just a construct? Well, to some degree, you don't know enough about me to know exactly, you know, am I really just, you know, a man? I mean, who knows? It's possible. But I haven't told you everything. So I could be something interesting, like something original, something different, right? But, you know, I kind of look, it's easier to get along that way, right, if I look one way. That could be, right? Or it could be that But the main point is, yes, maybe I am kind of biologically considered a man, maybe, but I don't operate under that. I don't make a construct out of it. I'm not thinking about that. So if I'm up in the Sierras all alone in the mountains, the idea that I'm a man probably doesn't, you know, mean much. But then in some kind of setting, it means a lot. I went home during supper, and I'd never seen this neighbor across the street, but my wife said, wow, the testosterone is up across the street. There were like 4 Harley-Davidson motorcycles and 2 low-riding cars and these guys, jeans and t-shirts, and like strutting around. And that was interesting. So you know, those are my people. I should join them, you know. And it becomes an idea. And so it's the operating of an idea, an operator of the construct is how we suffer. And so meditation practice, one of the functions of it is to begin relaxing and softening in these identities, to see how they operate, and beginning to discover how to be present without them getting in the way, without them interfering or being a shell. And certainly being a man, in my case, is an okay construct. It's not necessarily a bad one. And sometimes it's expected. You know, if it's a little bit, society work runs a little bit easier if I go into the men's bathroom rather than the women's. It's kind of like a construct that I, you know, it's less chaos. But I don't have to, so then I put it on, I live that way sometimes. But, if you tell me, a real man doesn't wear glasses, that's not going to do anything for me. My identity is not tied around being a real man and what all society thinks that means. And all these Harleys across the street, motorcycles, let it be. And then sometimes having an identity is useful. This is also interesting. But interesting walk. I took my walk with my wife when I had dinner at home. And around the block, there was some people were talking very loudly. So we kept walking. And then it sounded really bad, like fight or something, but we couldn't see. And then someone drove by, a woman, and she said, "These people back there are fighting." So I went back. And there were four people, and there was a lot of yelling, and I didn't see any fighting at that moment, but there was a woman who was like covering her face like with her hands, and I don't know if she was just simply distraught or whether she'd, was hurt and holding her wounded face, and this guy with bloody hand. So I didn't know what was going on. So I went over, and I said, "Can I help here? Anything I can do?" And they said, "No, this is just a family argument. It's okay." And I said, "Oh, okay, but is there anything I can do?" And no. And then I said, and this is where I assumed an identity. It was useful. I said, "I'm a minister. Is there anything I can do?" And then things changed. As soon as I said I was a minister, and then they didn't want to dismiss me so quickly. And so then, we talked, and he wanted to shake my hands, and I didn't really want to shake that bloody hand, so I kind of did it limply on the edge of the fingers. But he really wanted to shake my hand, like it was like important for him. This guy, he was distraught, and so I shook his hand, and firm handshake. So sometimes we play these constructs, and so I took on the persona of being a minister. It wasn't so far fetched, right? And given my role. Buddhist minister. I didn't tell him I was a Buddhist minister. And then my wife waited along the sides for me to finish my little conversation. And so when I joined her again, I can tell you I was no longer a minister. She would not have put up with that. So these things are fluid, right? But what is not fluid? What do you get caught in? What do you get stuck in? What is it when you sit down to meditate, do you keep repeating over and over again the concerns you have? And how do those concerns relate to your identity, to what you believe about yourself, and how you have to be seen, how you want to be seen, and how you have to prove yourself, and all these ideas? And it's such a relief to have an experience where we radically put down these ideas. Radically, at least temporarily, we don't need them anymore. Have an experience of ourselves free of any idea of identity, any idea of who we think we should be or have to be, or any idea of needing to defend ourselves or other people. Just have the experience of just being, just to be, is such a relief. So there was a famous person who was considered the founder of Zen in China, Chan in China, named Bodhidharma. And they say he came from India to China. And when he got there, he had an audience with one of the greatest emperors of China, Emperor Wu. And Emperor Wu had built a lot of Buddhist temples and was very devout Buddhist. And the emperor in China was like, he's the top of the hierarchy. He's like considered almost like the son of God or something, the son of heaven, and very important person. And so very devout and support a lot of monastics and translating texts and building temples and all this stuff. So this Zen monk walks into the court and he's a foreigner. Sometimes in the Chinese texts they call him barbarian from the West, Western barbarian. So he must have stood out being a foreigner in China in the court. And so the emperor said, "Who are you?" And now you don't mess with the emperor, unless you have a lot of confidence. And I think Bodhidharma had a lot of confidence. Because when he said, when the emperor said, "Who are you?" Bodhidharma said, "I don't know. I don't know." Isn't that? And so then the emperor asked, "How much merit have I gotten from building all these temples?" And Bodhidharma said, "No merit." And then the emperor said, "What's the highest meaning of the holy truths of Buddhism?" And Bodhidharma said, "No meaning." Actually, then he asked, "Well, who are you?" And Bodhidharma said, "I don't know." And then Bodhidharma turned around and left, and this emperor was kind of stunned. And when you kind of like stop being stunned, his ministers explained to him that he was this great Buddhist teacher from India. And then he tried to get his people to go find him and bring him back, but it was too late. So this is a story they tell, a teaching story they tell in Zen. So, but this idea of, "I don't know, who are you? I don't know." Can you say that? And in what way can you say that with a confidence that you could say that in the court in front of the emperor? You know, like, you, it's not like you don't know because you're like, I don't know, I'm confused. I haven't figured it out yet. But rather, "I don't know, and I don't need to know. I don't know, and I don't need to know." So what happens if you don't know? The other thing they say in Zen, they say, not knowing is most intimate. Sometimes in Zen, enlightenment is almost described in terms of intimacy. It's kind of nice, especially in America where we like being relationship. You know, so what is the, you know, so, you know, we want to be intimate. So how do you be intimate with someone? And the Zen answer is, you don't know. You don't come with preconceived ideas. You don't come with agendas. You don't come with yourself as being a certain person. You don't let, you insist the other person be. But you meet in some kind of space where there's possibility for something new. And in fact, I think we're constantly becoming new. We're constantly getting renewed. So much so that this is also the kind of the Zen view of this whole self thing. And sometimes in Zen, you can be asked, "Who are you?" And sometimes they give a very concrete, very specific answer. It's not this ambiguous, "I don't know." So if one of you asked me, "Who am I?" One answer would be, I would pick up the glass and drink. And that's the answer. That's a Zen thing, right? And the point of it is that while I'm drinking, I'm the drinker. But, you know, even to say I'm a drinker is saying too much. So you just demonstrate it. That's who I am. But I put it down, I stop being that. And then what am I now? Now I'm a talker, a Dharma talker. And when I go home to my wife, you know, so we discover, so the point being, we discover who we are in the activity that we're doing at the time we're doing it, rather than that we have a certain identity. So, you know, rather than me being a man, I would be, I guess, manning. You know, if I'm manning, I'm a man, right? But that makes it much more fluid, and I think much more respectful, because maybe there are times when I'm womaning. You know, is that allowed for men? You know, just you are what you are the activity that you do, and that's how you discover. And you don't need to bring anything with you from the past. It's okay to drop the past to some degree, you know, and not know. And this stepping in. So earlier I talked about stepping off the cliff into the unknown. And part of that is being willing to go a step forward and not carry with us identity, not carrying with us ideas of who we have to be. And willing to just be without a wall, without something that the balls of life have to strike. And so not to know, not to know who you are, not as a lack of confidence, not as ambiguity, not as confusion, but maybe as tremendous confidence that you can discover in the activity that you meet, that you encounter, whatever you're doing, whatever is needed. And then that, so if you're not doing anything at all and someone says, "Who are you?" you say, "I don't know." But if you're sweeping the hall out there after a meal, then you're a sweeper. And that's all it is. As opposed to you're sweeping the hall out there and you need to prove to all these good people that you're a really dedicated, devoted student, member of IMC and, you know, important person here and, you know, has a really important role. And I bet everybody's noticing, you know, I chose a job, you know, right in the middle where everyone's walking so that everyone can see that I am volunteering and, you know, I'm not a slacker. And, you know, it's all this self going on. So what we are then, we discover, is what we're a self-maker. We're, you know, making up selves and venting selves and all that stuff. That's what's happening at that moment. As opposed to, they asked me to sweep, I'm a sweeper now. So the journey out of the shell of self, the journey out of the constriction of self, the way we limit ourselves by our ideas. And when we learn to drop some of these ideas and not live by them, then there can be much more freedom in picking them up too, when they're useful. It's useful to be a sweeper. It's useful to be a minister when neighbors are fighting. And by the way, you know. And but then, you know, I don't, because you, then it's much more fluid with them. We pick them up when they're useful. We live them when they're useful. We play the games, the rules when it's useful. That then comes with some identities. And then we can put them down. And then to feel confident, feel safe, feel at ease enough that we don't have to play the self game. We don't have to do anything. It's okay just to be. It's okay just to be and breathe. We're safe. Deep safety. And we're actually less safe when we're playing the self game. So do less. Just be. Just be. So a journey. A journey to confident not knowing who you are. So you can discover anew every day. Okay. That seems like enough. And thank you for coming today. It's kind of a wonderful thing, this long day, and, you know, the spirit of generosity where someone comes and offers breakfast and someone comes along, and Martha came real early and helped, thank you, and Hillary was doing, you know, getting supplies yesterday, and other people helped, Bruni helped, and Don and Bill, and a lot of people helped, but all of you probably had a role of some kind. And nothing else, you came to practice here. And your practice, the fact that you're practicing here, whether you intended or not, probably you didn't intend it, is a support for everyone else. And that the fact, you know, it's, that's why we come together sometimes, is so we have the support of others. It's difficult to do a whole day like this or hours like this if you're just doing it on your own. So you offered something by being here. And hopefully you received something too and felt the support of others. So I want to thank you for coming, and I hope that the journey of the day has been meaningful for you in some ways, helpful in some ways, and I hope that the rest of your weekend is a wonderful discovery of how little you need to know, how little you need to know about yourself, except you can discover it as you go along, and then you let it go. Okay, so thank you very much.